Thanks for joining us today on Mormon Land, where we explore news in and about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I am Peggy Fletcher Stack, the Salt Lake Tribune Senior Religion Reporter, and I am on assignment this week in the Middle East. We remind our listeners about another way to support Mormon Land. Just go to patreon.com, where with a small donation, you can access transcripts to our podcasts and our complete newsletter. Again, that's Patreon, patreon.com/Mormon Land. We love our listeners. Mormon Land wouldn't be here without you. We started Mormon Land to explore the contours and complexities of Latter-day Saints news and culture. Now we would appreciate your input about how we're doing. We've launched a survey just for you, our podcast listeners, to find out how to continue bringing content that you enjoy. The survey link is in our show notes. 5 minutes of your time could help us create hours of future content. Thanks so much for your help, and thanks for listening. Now to today's show. This is Holy Week for Western Christians, which culminates on Sunday with Easter. Israel is awash in pilgrims and tourists who are drinking in the sights of Jesus' last days, including members of the LDS Church. It also signals the opening after 2 years of Brigham Young University's Jerusalem Center for Near East Studies. In this special edition of Mormon Land, I am here in person with Eric D. Huntsman, a religious studies expert and the center's new academic director, to talk about what to expect in the coming days and how this place can deepen spirituality. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Peggy, for having me, and welcome to this wonderful place, both Jerusalem and the Holy Land in general.
How did you get interested in biblical studies?
That's a question, so I'll try to keep this reasonably concise. My professional training is not in biblical studies, it's in classical studies. So I did my undergraduate majors at BYU in classical Greek and Latin, and then did my doctoral work in ancient history, particularly Greek and Roman history. So my first 9 years teaching at BYU was in the classics department. But my interest in the Bible goes all the way back to my very first year of seminary. I grew up in western Pennsylvania, just outside of Pittsburgh, and then graduated from high school in western Tennessee. And the distances there are really great. You know, we drove a long way for church, and I only had 1 year of early morning seminary. The rest were home study seminary years. It was that first year in Pittsburgh, and as chance had it, it was the Old Testament. And most people, well, we're doing it in Come Follow Me this year, and I'm hoping people are having a better experience with the Old Testament than they've had before, but most people don't really enjoy the Old Testament or understand it, but for some reason, it just clicked with me. And it was particularly the historical books. I liked the books of Kings and Chronicles. I just thought were so fascinating. I'd get the Bible maps out and try to figure out where the battles were and what Jerusalem looked like. And so I always had this real interest in the history of this particular land. Now, as chance had it, I finished high school in western Tennessee, where I often tell people I got Jesus, so to speak, under the influence of my evangelical friends. I was raised in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and that's where my testimony and loyalty still lie. But my friends really helped me focus more on Jesus Christ as my Savior. And so the New Testament increasingly became what I loved. And even when I started studying classics, one of the reasons I was interested in studying Greek is because I wanted to study the New Testament, particularly the book of John. And that was just really my love. So I was teaching classics at BYU, but more and more I wanted to teach the New Testament. And so after 9 years, I transferred from the classical studies over to the Department of Ancient Scripture. And then as chance had it, I had an opportunity a few years later to come here on a professional development trip. And then I received an assignment to teach for a year in 2011 at the BYU Jerusalem Center. And I just fell so in love with this land and both its peoples and all of its faiths. And so I would look for every opportunity I could possibly find to come back. You know, my family had a good experience here, but Elaine and the kids, they didn't want to move back here necessarily. So I'd find opportunities to come with tours or lead groups, and I'd come once or twice a year, and then this recent opportunity has opened up for me to be here for 2 or 2.5 years. And I'm just really, really glad to be back.
How has your view of the place changed over time?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, the first time I came was while I was still studying classics as an undergraduate at BYU. I think it was in 1988, maybe 89, 88. I went to the Vienna Austria study abroad program, and it was a 6-month program, and we got to do these exchanges, they call them. So we'd do a week and a half in London, and we'd do a week and a half at the Jerusalem Center. And the Jerusalem Center was new. It had just barely opened. And because of that, you know, teenage interest in Old Testament history and then that continuing love of the New Testament, I was just really excited to be here. But I have to admit, I was pretty naive about the history and the politics. I mean, I knew the scriptural history, but the political history, I just didn't really understand. And all I knew is what I'd seen on the news. And I was kind of fearful and I worried about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But when we came here on our assignment in 2011, and I actually got to know people, that changed everything. Both Israelis and Palestinians, people who love their families, they love their land, they love their communities, they were peaceful, they just wanted what was best. Yes, they had disagreements and there were conflicts, but it broadened my view. And you'll often hear me talk about the Holy Land more than I talk about Israel or Palestine, because this land is important and sacred to both of them. And for those of us in the Christian tradition, it's been sacred since the time of Jesus. There's a period of history that many people aren't aware of. Perhaps this is the Roman historian in me, but I love what's called the Byzantine period. That's a modern term to describe the late Christian phase of the Roman Empire. I always tell my students it's Greek-speaking Christian Romans. And from the time of Constantine, about 325, when he sent his mother here to find the holy sites, until Jerusalem fell to the Arabs about 638, there was an almost 300-year period where this was a Christian city, Greek-speaking Christian city. That's longer than the United States has been a country, and people don't realize that that's a big part of its history. And the Byzantines called what we now call Israel and the Palestinian territories and Jordan the Holy Land. Any place where scriptural events happened was holy and important to them. And so that was a different view I've had, and that I try to maintain. You know, I'll often say to people, I love this land, I love both its peoples, I love all of its religions. And it's not just the ones we're familiar with, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. You know, the Baha'i have an important presence here, and it's just a place where people who are drawn to God are themselves drawn. It's almost hard to explain. Now, unfortunately, that sometimes has resulted in wars. People fight over wanting this place. But, you know, even in the atrocities of the Crusades, I mean, people were drawn here because of what it meant to their faith. Now, what they did when they got here and how they treated the people who were already here was terrible. But I think the impulse for many people was the same thing that you and I feel being here this week. The other thing that's interesting is that this is not just a holy land. This is a sacred time. Now, using perhaps some Latter-day Saint terminology and experiences to explain this, you know, in our religious community, temples and our homes are holy places, places that we set apart from the rest of the world as a place where God's Spirit can dwell, where heaven and earth meet. But just like we have holy places set apart from the rest of the world, we have sacred time, which is demarcated from the regular flow of time. Now, in the Latter-day Saint tradition, the one that we focus on is our weekly Sabbath. And President Nelson has really encouraged us to keep the Sabbath and make that a sign of our faith. What are we offering God by how we worship Him and what we focus on that day? And, of course, we are big lovers of Christmas. And I wish more so even of Easter. But this idea of sacred time, I think, is really, really important. And here in this land, and in some Christian traditions, Catholicism, Orthodoxy, High Church Protestants, the idea of Holy Week, Palm Sunday through Easter, and even before that, Lent, the 40 days plus the Sundays involved in that period, are a period of preparation and spiritual focus, where you turn away from your daily concerns to focus more on God.
So how did Holy Week get started?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. There was early on, we know, in the first centuries of Christianity, something they called the Triduum Paschale, or the Paschal 3 days, which would be what we would call Maundy or Holy Thursday, Good Friday, well, the evening of Maundy Thursday. So Thursday evening through Friday, then Friday evening through Saturday, and then to Easter. So three holy days. But there was this Spanish nun named Egeria who came to the Holy Land on pilgrimage in the late 4th century. And she, fortunately, wrote down in detail her experiences. She went to all these different sites and the things she experienced. And she noticed that what was interesting about coming to these sacred sites, these holy places, is those holy places had particular meaning when you use them to recount events from biblical and, in particular, Christian history. So she recounted how on Palm Sunday, the Sunday before Easter, all the local Christians would go up the Mount of Olives and they would have prayers and they would read from Matthew 21 the account of the triumphal entry, and then they would follow the bishop who was riding a mule, just like Christ rode donkey, down the hill singing and chanting and praying. Now, I saw you there on Sunday, so I know you were there this year. There are thousands of people there, the local Christian community, which I'll come back to in a moment, and then thousands of pilgrims, including members of the Latter-day Saint branch here. We all went up to a place called Bethphage, which is the traditional spot where Jesus, after he climbed the east side of the Mount of Olives from Bethany, got on a donkey and then rode it down the west side and came into the city in triumph. And it was a party. I wanted to come back to our local Christian community. You know, the Christians here are a minority within a minority. They're mostly Palestinian. And the Palestinians, of course, their intention with the Israelis or the Jewish Israelis. And then, although most Palestinians are Muslim, there historically has been a large Christian contingent. In fact, I asked one of my friends here, how long has your family been Christian? He said, since Peter and Paul. They were actually my Byzantine friends, right? They were the Greek-speaking Christian Romans who, after the Arab invasion, adopted Arabic culture and language, but they kept their Christian faith. But Holy Week and Christmas time is when they literally come out of the woodwork and can be openly Christian. I read in your postcard about Palm Sunday that a local member of our branch here, a teenager, said, you know, sometimes I feel almost alone here as a Christian, but wow, I was here with all these other Christians. So Egeria tells us about that. She then said that on Mondays and Tuesdays, they would gather in the churches and read what Jesus did those days and have prayers. And then things really started to pick up after that. On Wednesdays, they commemorated Jesus' anointing by the woman and Judas's decision to betray her. In fact, Egeria says that when they read the account of Judas deciding to take the pieces of silver, that the whole congregation would groan as they thought of this horrible betrayal. And then, of course, on Thursday, they would recount the institution of what we call the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. And in this place today, they will have a procession, at least the Catholic procession begins at a church called St. Saviour's, which is where the Franciscan Custody of the Holy Land is headquartered. They have a procession from there to a place on Mount Zion called the Kenicle, which means the dinner place in Latin, and that is built on an earlier Crusader site, which was built on an earlier Byzantine church called Holy Zion. It was the place that commemorated the Last Supper and the gift of the Spirit at Pentecost. And they have a procession there, and then they hold a Mass, and they celebrate the Eucharist, what we would call the sacrament. Then on Thursday evening, and if you're here, you ought to come, they have a service in the Basilica of the Agony, also called Basilica or the Church of All Nations in Gethsemane, where the accounts of Jesus in the garden is read in lots of languages. It takes a while. And just as Jesus bid his disciples to watch with him, the idea is Christians should be willing to watch with Jesus that night. And then, of course, after the betrayal and the arrest, Jesus was dragged down the Kidron Valley to Caiaphas's palace. And there is a candlelight procession from Gethsemane all the way to Mount Zion to a church called St. Peter Gallicantu, or St. Peter the Cockcrow, which commemorates both Jesus' imprisonment under the Jewish authorities, his hearing or his examination under the high priest and the Sanhedrin, but also Peter's denial of him. That I always expected that to be really solemn, you know, this quiet candlelight procession. But once again, the local Christians, this is when they can be Christians, so they actually sing and dance and party all the way there, and there's a party afterwards. And then, of course, Good Friday is a very solemn day, as it should be. You know, I often tell people that Good Friday is to Easter what Christmas Eve is to Christmas. You can't have one without the other. And growing up as a Latter-day Saint, you know, we didn't celebrate Good Friday. In fact, I remember asking my mother once, we lived in Pittsburgh, where most of my friends were Catholic. I said, Mom, what's so good about Good Friday? You know, I didn't understand the history that good meant God, so it's God's Friday, the day that he reconciled the world to himself. I do remember that we had fish on Fridays during Lent in the cafeteria in Pittsburgh, and I remember that we didn't have school on Friday. It was funny when you may want to ask about this, how I, as a Latter-day Saint, became such a proponent of Holy Week, but I started keeping my children home on Good Friday. And our family tradition is to go to the temple when they were little to do baptisms for the dead. But then we go to the local Episcopalian church for a Good Friday service. And then I take them out to dinner. So it just feels like a holiday. So anyway, the first time we did that, Timview High School called and said, "Your daughter, Rachel, isn't in school today. Where is she?" I said, "Well, we kept her home. It's a holiday." "What holiday is it?" I said, "It's Good Friday." And they said, "What are you?" You know, Provost, largely Latter-day Saint. And I just said, "Christian." So Good Friday is this solemn day where we recount how Jesus, who took upon himself the burden of our sins, our sorrows, our disappointments, our heartaches. I mean, Alma 7 explains this so beautifully, what Gethsemane was really about. And here on the Jerusalem Center campus, we have some olive presses. And you think of the crushing weight that literally pressed blood out of every pore. And because Latter-day Saints do have such theological insight into the Gethsemane aspect of the atoning sacrifice, I know when I was growing up, it was almost like the atonement happened in Gethsemane. We almost didn't talk about the cross. But if you really understand the theology, Jesus took the burden there, which crushed him, but then he carried it. The way I teach this is I always say that, you know, Leviticus 1 talks about sacrificial practice. You would bring a sacrificial victim to the door of the tent of the congregation or to the temple courts. And you put your hands on, say, "This for me." And then the priests and Levites would lead that sacrifice to the altar where they would slay it and pour the blood out on the north side. And they'd burn on the altar and the smoke would rise up to God. That sacrificial procedure, to me, illustrates what the atoning sacrifice was. Jesus took the burden in Gethsemane and he carried it all the way to the cross. And then he poured out his blood on the cross. But the atonement extends all the way to Easter morning. So just as the smoke rose up to God, so Jesus rose with healing in his wings from the tomb and then went up to heaven. And so the solemnity of Good Friday makes the joy of Easter morning all the more. On Saturday, it's a day of waiting. And this is something I think sometimes we miss in our community, and yet we experience it all the time. It's what we call a liminal space and time. Liminal means a borderland. And you know, Jesus didn't die on the cross and then immediately resurrect. His friends and his family, and indeed his own spirit, were left in suspense, right? So there's this period where they had to sit with the pain and the grief and the loss. And how often do we in our own lives find ourselves in that period of waiting and grief, which makes the joy of Easter all the greater? Now, in the Greek Orthodox tradition, and they'll be doing this a week later than the Western Christians, they actually have a great tradition called Holy Fire. And so the Easter Vigil starts at sundown Saturday evening, and so you're waiting for the resurrection. And the Greek Orthodox patriarch goes into this little shrine in the Church of the Sepulchre called the Edicle, which surrounds what's left of the tomb. And he comes in with a candle, and he comes out with a candle alight. And the story is that it miraculously burst in flame. But not just in the church, but in the courtyard in front of it, and throughout the streets of the Christian quarter, people are waiting with candles. They're actually thick candles made out of 33 tapers for each of the years of Jesus' life. And they pass this flame from person to person. And you can literally watch this wave of little flames passing out. But the idea is the light of Jesus Christ that was temporarily put out burst back into flames. And then it's up for us, up to us to carry that light through all the world. And I understand that they used to take it on planes to Greece and Russia, right? And that holy fire that started at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre goes to all the countries of the earth, just as we're told we're supposed to take the light of the gospel everywhere. Did that answer your question about the history and how this happens?
Do you have a favorite part of Holy Week?
Oh, Peggy, that's like saying you have a favorite child. I mean, you love all your children, but sometimes you like one more than the other. Palm Sunday, I love. I'll tell you when. Do you want to know how I started to become a Latter-day Saint practitioner of this?
Sure.
It's a little odd, I guess. I mean, there's that idea of, you know, holy envy. It's because as a young bishop, I was so excited to have my first Easter program. It's because my mother was a musician. Sorry, I always get a little verklempt when I talk about mom.
You know, my mother blessed my life in so many ways. She's been dead now since 2014, but she not only gave me the gift of music, she also is the one who gave me the gift of Jesus. I dedicated one of my books to her, and I said I learned about Jesus at her knee, but I didn't just learn about him. I learned how to serve him from her. And she would do these Christmas and Easter programs in Pittsburgh and Tennessee that were way beyond the reach of our little word choir. You know, we'd be singing Messiah, that kind of thing. But the idea of having scriptural narrations and good music that brought the Spirit. So I thought, I'm going to be like Mom. Well, it turned out that Easter was on Fast Sunday that year. And I asked my stake president, I said, can we move Fast Sunday a week so that, you know, we can have an Easter program? He said, well, you know, I think actually testimony means a great way to celebrate Easter, which ideally it could be if it's a good testimony meeting and not, you know, kind of a group therapy as sometimes they turn out to be. So I thought, okay, we'll do it a week before. And I, what I want to do is prime the pump so that would be a great Easter service, even as a testimony meeting. So I published in the Word Bulletin that week what Jesus said and did on each of those days. I basically gave my ward a reading schedule for Palm Sunday and each of the days up to Easter. And my thought was, if we're all reading this, we'll come to testimony meeting and it will be good. But I wanted to do this whole Easter program, a la my mother, on Palm Sunday. And as I was putting the narration together, I was so attracted to Palm Sunday and Jesus being our King. And so we ended up having a Palm Sunday program, if that makes any sense. And so what Elaine, my wife, and I did, and we continued this with our children as they came, is that we kept using that funny little ward reading schedule I came up with. I've refined it and corrected it since then. I was a classicist at the time and didn't know the Bible as well as I know now. But we decided that just as we have a tradition in our family of taking the month of December to prepare for Christmas, having devotionals every night, singing Christmas carols, we're going to take the week before Easter to get ready for Easter. And so I remember Rachel was just a baby, so she wasn't participating, but we were reading the account of the Last Supper in Gethsemane together, Elaine and I. And we ended up just bearing her testimonies of Jesus, what he had done for us. And to hear my wife say she knew that Jesus had taken her burdens on him, it just touched me. So I guess Thursday would be it. But then, as I said, we've developed these traditions about Good Friday. And of course, I love Easter. So I'm going to pull one out of the hat, which is one people don't know about. It's called Spy Wednesday. Now, according to Mark, followed by Matthew, there are these three short episodes which I think arguably happened on the Wednesday of Holy Week. It is the decision of the Jerusalem leadership to put Jesus to death, to find him, to arrest him. And then there's this beautiful scene where an unnamed woman comes in and anoints his feet at a supper in Bethany. And then there's the closing scene where Judas meets with those Jerusalem leaders and agrees to betray Jesus. So you've got this chiasm, right? You've got two dark conspiratorial episodes, which is why it's called Spy Wednesday. But they frame this beautiful episode of Jesus being anointed by a woman. Now, I love this because this woman who is not named, there's a similar passage in John 12 where Mary of Bethany does it, but in Mark and Matthew, it's an unnamed woman. She comes in and anoints Jesus. You know, the disciples get upset. What a waste of this precious ointment. Should have been given to the poor, the money. And he says, she's doing this to prepare me for my burial. So what does that mean? It means this woman knew that Jesus had come to die. Now, if you read Mark carefully, the male disciples are always getting it wrong. They're getting confused. They're wrong. Even Peter has this great testimony that Jesus is the Christ, but he doesn't understand he's coming to die for him. The very next passage is Jesus says, "I'm Son of Man's going to Jerusalem, will be betrayed, he'll suffer, and he'll die." Peter's like, "No way!" You know. So the men come to know who he is, but they don't see clearly yet what he's come to do. But this woman did. And then Jesus said, "Wherever this gospel shall be preached, this will be taught as a memorial for her." I thought, I've been studying the gospel my entire life and no one's ever talked to me about this story about a woman. And Jesus said we're supposed to remember it. And so we developed a little tradition in our family that we read these three stories and we talk about this woman and her testimony of Christ. And what we do is we go around the room and we talk about women of Christ in our life who Paul talks about this in 2 Timothy. He says to Timothy, you know, your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, they planted the seed of faith in your hearts. We go around and we talk about women of Christ who have planted and nourished our testimonies of Jesus. And Sam, I have a son, he's now 19, but when he was young and he's a special needs son, you know, it was always like, I'm thankful for my aid. I'm thankful for mommy. You know, I'm thankful for my teacher. But, you know, it's always been this wonderful opportunity for me to, A, talk about their grandmothers. And they don't really know very well because they're dead. I talk about my mother and how she shaped my faith. And then I get to look my children in the eyes and say, and your mother is a woman of Christ. Your mother knows that Jesus is the Son of God, and she knows that he suffered and died for her. It's a quiet celebration. It's a home-based, family-based Holy Week celebration, but that's one of my favorites.
I love that. So why do you think so many Christians are drawn to these sites, even the ones that are nothing like what they were during Jesus' time, they're actually the site at all?
That's an interesting question, because particularly for Protestants and Latter-day Saints, some of the more liturgical, involved ritual kind of practices of the Roman Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox are unfamiliar. They're foreign. For some, even off-putting. I mean, one of the reasons Charles Gordon, who discovered the so-called Skull Hill and Garden Tomb, was looking for another site for the tomb is because Holy Sepulchre didn't do it for him, right? And so it's an interesting question. And sometimes students will say, oh, you know, they go up to Galilee where it's open and you can see a hillside, or you get a dirt trail. I can imagine Jesus walking on that trail, but they see this church and they say, I can't even picture what it was like. And I always tell them, you should be grateful for that church. Now, first of all, you mentioned we don't always know exactly where they were. Some of the most pivotal sites, when Helena Constantine's mother came in 325, there were local Christians who said, my grandfather said someone. So there's a chain of transmission. So some of the sites are pretty reliable. But, you know, it's like anything. A lot of them probably when Christian tourism became a thing, you know, some are probably made up. But I say to my students, if the Byzantines hadn't built a church there and the Crusaders hadn't come later when they weren't busy killing people and rebuilt a church there, and if later the Franciscans and the Greeks didn't rebuild those churches, that would be a parking lot or a shopping mall. And if you think you can't imagine what the garden was like in the Holy Sepulchre, you wouldn't imagine it if it were a high-rise building or a parking lot. So that's something to keep in mind. You know, I always try to be grateful for those who have come before us who have been custodians of these sites. No, I even feel that way about the Islamic sites on the Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary, what the Jews call the Temple Mount. They're custodians of a site that's sacred, and they're maintaining it as a place of prayer. To me, that means something. And but back to your question, why are people drawn to it? You know, as believers in a God who's in yonder heavens, and even a believer in Jesus, whom we can imagine and picture, but he's not here with us, we're all seeking for something tangible. We want to reach out and encounter and touch deity, right? And I think that's why in every religious tradition, I mean, Latter-day Saints are not unique in really respecting their leaders and looking to their leaders. You know, the rebbes, the great rabbis here, and some of them Muslim leaders and Christian leaders. We look to our leaders because they represent God to us, and they're people we can see, and if we get a chance, touch them, right? But when you come to the places where Jesus was, even though he's not here, it's a feeling of connection. I think that's what Aguirre was saying back in the late 4th century. People began coming on pilgrimage here because they knew Jesus had been here. And it's just another way of trying to reach the Savior who is not currently with them. Now, if I can take off my professorial and my confessional hats, so I'm setting aside my religion and my profession for a moment and be mystical for a moment. I believe in spiritual things. And I believe that spirit is just another sense, like our five physical senses. I believe that places and times where God has intervened in this world contain echoes of that, if that makes any sense. You know, there's that early Jesus movie, The Greatest Story Ever Told. Gosh, the most important things in the history of the universe happen in this land. How could that not leave a spiritual echo? And what reinforces that is the faith of all the people who've celebrated it. You know, we can have this discussion about Holy Sepulchre versus Garden Tomb, but the reality is millions of people have commemorated the resurrection in those two places. So even if one or both of them are not the exact site, the faith of people who have worshipped there have made it sacred. So you've got the primary echo, which is Jesus was here. God
he was here. And then you have all the people who remembered that God and Jesus were here. And it's just kind of cumulative. It just builds. And I guess the question is, how can we celebrate that and add our own voice to that echo in a positive, loving, peaceful, compassionate way, not in confessional discord and religious fights and feuds and political disharmony? You know, and that's one of the gifts of this land. I remember once I had to go buy a piece of PVC pipe for my daughter. We were getting ready to go home after our first stint here, and she wanted to try off the color guard. She wanted a PVC pipe so she could practice twirling things. So I went up onto this neighborhood on top of Mount of Olives here, Atur, and walked into this little Muslim shop in Ramadan. And he was wearing the more, you know, serious Muslim garb. And he clearly did not like me. And I got my piece of PVC pipe, and I went to buy it. And after I bought it, I looked up and I said, "Ramadan Kareem. Have a blessed and full Ramadan." And this man burst into this smile that was just infectious. Because I wasn't just some American, right? I was someone who cared about what he cared about. And I recognized that what he believed was important to him, even if I wasn't fasting or celebrating Ramadan. Does that make any sense? Little things that we can do. And we can do that back home. We can do that in the avenues or in Provo. Not just with people of other faiths. We can be a lot more generous to each other within the Latter-day Saint community. You know, we've been through this horrible period of pandemic where political divisions and divisions over vaccines and masks and all these things have split us apart. We can be a little bit more generous to each other. If you don't get a vaccine, you can respect those who choose to get it. And if you did get it, you cannot be so critical of those who don't. You know, it just, this is the message, right? This was the message of Moses and Jesus and Muhammad. There's a reason the Holy Quran talks about God as the merciful and the compassionate. There's a reason why the most common description of Jehovah in the Hebrew Bible is chesed, full of loving kindness. There's a reason why Paul said, charity never faileth. There's a reason why one of my favorite passages in the Book of Mormon is Mormon speaking in Moroni 7. Pray with all the energy of heart that you may be filled with this love, which is the pure love of Christ. And whether you are a Christian or a Latter-day Saint Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Baha'i or a Hindu or a person of no faith, just a good secular humanist, why can't it be about love and goodness? That's the gift the Holy Land has given me. A place which you see on the news is a place of some of the worst conflict and division and contention, and yet a place where I've learned the most tolerance and love.
So you've kind of already answered this, but how has being here affected your Latter-day Saint faith?
It's made it richer and deeper. We had a testimony meeting just this last week, and of course, I shared my witness, and it was focused on Holy Week and sacred time, what Jesus had done for us, but I finished it by saying, and this is the same Jesus of the Restoration. As a Latter-day Saint, I believe that Jesus who rose from that tomb appeared in the sacred grove. I believe he stood on the altar of the Kirtland Temple. I believe that Joseph and Sidney saw him in vision, as recorded in section 76. It's proof positive that the Jesus who rose from the tomb still lives and that he's still part of the world today.
So, last question, what do you wish church members understood about the Holy Land?
Well, after this big advertisement for the Holy Land and pilgrimage and coming here, I remember teaching a Christ in the Everlasting Gospel section at BYU, and it was the last session, and it was called Jesus the Restoration, and I shared some of these episodes I've just mentioned. And we had little blurbs from DVD the church had put out with some of the brethren sharing testimonies at different places. And Elder Todd Christofferson was at the Sacred Grove, and he talked about going there as a young man. And by the way, I meant to mention this earlier. Latter-day Saints' point of contact for this can be anyone who's gone to the Sacred Grove or anyone who's gone to Carthage Jail, right, and felt a connection to the Prophet Joseph, understands holy places and sacred time. But anyway, Elder Christofferson was mentioning going to the Sacred Grove as a young man and just expecting to have this barn-burning experience that didn't happen. And then he said weeks, I don't remember how much longer, he was at home with his copy of the Book of Mormon, and he was in his bedroom, lying in bed or kneeling in bed, I don't remember, And that's when the witness came. So after this big commercial for the Holy Land and Holy Week, what I want Latter-day Saints to know is, wherever they are, whenever they are, they can have this testimony. Because it's as real in Kanab as it is in Jerusalem.
Well, Eric Huntsman, thank you very much for sharing your views and your experiences of the Holy Land with
Thanks,
our
Peg.
Listeners.
I'm glad you could be here with us this year.
It's very exciting for me as well. Again, we thank Eric Huntsman and our producer, Chris Samuels. We remind our readers that they can keep up on all the happenings in and about the church by subscribing to the Salt Lake Tribune's free Mormon Land newsletter. Just go to sltrib.com to sign up, and we'll talk again next time on Mormon Land.